I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 50 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off week 10 of this season is Scott Myers, an associate professor of screenwriting at DePaul University. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Great to be here. Looking forward to talking about the ending of this scene, which is one of the most important scenes in the movie.
Oh, nothing happens in this minute. You know, it's a boring minute. There's nothing here. Biggest thing since radio. But yeah,
that's right.
All right. So minute 50 begins with Sam explaining the catch and ends with George letting his emotions take over. All week we've been building up to this part of the movie. It's interesting how much time they spend in this screenplay keeping the two of these characters together in this room. You know, we had last week and this week. That's a significant chunk. There's probably 9 or 10 minutes of the two of them in Mary's house.
Yeah, and that speaks to the importance of the scene.
That's right. I mean, you as a screenwriter know that. You don't necessarily stay too long in the same place unless it's absolutely necessary and helpful to the way everything's moving along. So apparently they felt that way.
Nowadays, most scenes are no more than 2 pages long. Back in the day, when this movie was made, when it was a little bit more tied to what they used to call a screenplay, like two words, like a screen version of a play, you would have longer scenes because of more like plays. But even with that, this is a very long period of time that they're together in this confined environment. But again, it speaks to the importance of the moment.
Correct. And so basically the way we ended things yesterday was that George and Mary are on a phone call with Sam Wainwright. And George basically gave Sam a better way to utilize his idea to possibly make even more money. At this point, the two of them are listening to Sam's counteroffer, where he's now about to explain to them what it is that he really wants, you know, because he does have, I guess you can sort of say, ulterior motives for calling them, not just to pass the time and tell his friends, you know, how great time he's having in the theater district in New York. He wants to tell them something else. And he goes, now listen, have you got any money? So this reminds me of, like, you know, all those, you know, jokes with the African princes and stuff like that. You know, you get all those emails.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a scam. Have you got any money?
Yeah.
You know, it reminds me of in Unbreakable. You know, where David Dunn, you know, played by Bruce Willis, is constantly saying, at what point are you going to say, all I need now is just your credit card number? You know?
Right.
So that's pretty much what's going on here. You know, Sam, as the businessman, basically says, you know, okay, have you got any money? Money, yeah, well, a little. Well, now listen. I want you to put every cent you've got into our stock. Do you hear? And George, I may have a job for you. That is unless you're still married to that broken down building and loan. Well, this is the biggest thing since radio, and I'm getting you in on the ground floor. Oh, Mary, I'm here. Would you tell that guy I'm giving him the chance of a lifetime. Do you hear? The chance of a lifetime. So I'm actually going to stop talking about the dialogue at this point. We'll go to the second half of the dialogue a little bit later. First, let's go through this because as I'm sure Scott has been waiting months to talk about this. You know, so I'm just gonna, you know, basically milk it a little more before we get there.
Well, so, it's interesting he uses the word married. Unless you're still married to that broken down building alone. And of course the whole conversation started off in the parlor where they're talking about marriage.
Well, it makes sense for him to say that because you know, George is this you know, old single guy, old bachelor. You know, again, he's, what is he, 24? You know, let's see, if this is 1932 and he was born in 1907, so he's 25, okay? So he's completely over the hill. So obviously it makes sense for Sam to say, but then again, Sam also himself is single at this point, but he's enjoying the bachelor life a little more, as we saw earlier this week.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. George isn't necessarily enjoying it as to the same extent.
And it's in a way, you know, even though it's Sam making this offer, so it's different than just George going off on his own and seeing the world and building bridges and skyscrapers. It still is a significant opportunity that could potentially pull him out of Bedford Falls. And yet, in the moment, as we're going to see, that's not what happens. But he does have this option. There is a path out of Bedford Falls, potentially. You know, I mean, there may even be a job for him.
But do you think that the reason that he doesn't jump on it right away is because, you know, I think he's as much as he wants adventure, he still likes what's familiar. Like all of us. I mean, everyone's that way.
Yeah,
you want to keep the comforts of the familiarity or of home or whatever it is.
Well, and specifically in this scene, again, if you track the script, you know, they keep talking about the proximity, and his lips are almost on her lips, and he's smelling her and whatnot. That wherever that desire for adventure may be wanting to send him away from Bedford Falls, there's that need that's inside him. And we got a touch of it earlier where he talked about, well, his concern for the well-being of the people of Bedford Falls, that domesticity. You're seeing it right here where he is being pulled toward her. He's being pulled toward that life of what he was saying that he didn't want, which is to be married.
Right.
And so you're seeing that dual, that conflict, that inner conflict that he's got going on here. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and also, I mean, the way that Sam disparages the building and loan, you know, it means he doesn't believe it either.
No. No, because he's good. Sam, in a way, it's like, you know, you may look at it like Sam is kind of the ghost of Christmas future version of what, you know, George could have become if he'd gone off on his own. You know, Sam in the end, he does pay off. He does, you know, guarantee some money, you know, whatever. But he's not the most, you know, estimable guy. I mean, he's kind of a scam artist. He's a schemer, you know. And so if George hadn't,
but he's a good friend.
And he's a good friend, but he's a bit of a trickster too, you know, in his own way. So there's that, I guess, you know, it's just an interesting, what I like about it is that it gives him the option that George has in this moment, an option to leave, even if this may not be on the basis of what he may have anticipated, you know, going off and seeing the world. But it does give him a way to go that would not take him down the path he does choose, which is his need, which is what's emerging in this scene. So it's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's great the way that they do that here. I like the way that they do it because they're also showing us, the audience, George's possibilities. you know, his choices. You know, which path is he going to choose? Because again, we know, because we know what's going to happen in the movie, it makes it difficult for us to make that decision for him, since we know what path he chooses and why that is great for him. So, you know, I quite often wish, when I'm watching a movie that I love, that I'd be able to see it with fresh eyes once again. You know, just see it through the first time.
Oh yeah.
You know, and when you're watching it, then you would have your idea as to, okay, maybe this is what he should do, or maybe this is what he should what he shouldn't do, or whatever it is. But because, you know, when there's a movie that you're so familiar with, it's very difficult to reach that point. I mean, I've heard this story, and I've told this story numerous times over the past few seasons. And, you know, it's somewhat sad, but it really hits this point. I remember a few years ago seeing online the story of a man who The Empire Strikes Back was his favorite movie of all time. And he has some sort of disease which affects his short-term memory. So one of the things that his family does is every day they sit down and watch The Empire Strikes Back with him to see his reaction of how much he loves seeing it for the very first time over and over.
Oh, my God. You know, that's amazing.
And again, it's a sad story, but it's the idea that, you know, that if someone gets so much pleasure from seeing something the first time, you know, most of us don't have that option. You know, you see it once and that's it. You know, now your thoughts of it, I guess you could say, have been tainted, even though obviously as this podcast and similar podcasts have proved, you know, going more into depth of a movie isn't necessarily a bad thing. So, but you know, but once,
well, no, what you're doing with this, with what you're doing with this podcast and similar things, is you're getting to see the movie in a new way.
Yes,
you're getting completely. To see it at a level of depth, so it opens your eyes a little wider. Perhaps you've seen it at a certain level of optic range, but when you dig down into it, like what you do, you really begin to notice these nuances and subtleties that just play throughout. And so it is a way of kind of freshening the experience.
Right.
You know, I teach undergraduate students as well as graduate students. And, you know, you mentioned movies like Citizen Kane or Casablanca or It Happened One Night. And many of the students have not seen them. And at first I was always kind of like, wow, gee. But then I think, I wish I could switch positions with them so I could see these things for the first time. I mean,
the question is if they appreciate it on the same level that you would hope that you would appreciate it watching it for the first time again.
Well, I will say this. It happened one night, which I mentioned before, I did used to show when I taught this class, History of American Screenwriting. Mm-hmm. I watched the movie with them. I would watch the movie with them.
And watch their reaction?
Many of them had seen it for the first time. And they loved it. They just absolutely love that movie, you know. So it was great to see them watch a movie from 1934, black and white, you know, that they just complete. Double Indemnity is another one. They just thought, oh, that's awesome, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
because we're all movie geeks.
Yeah, this.
Come on.
yeah. Movies are life, man. Movies are totally life. Yeah.
For sure. So, I mean, first of all, you know, he mentions the fact that put every cent you have in there. I don't know if that is sound financial advice.
If he comes off like a scam artist, doesn't he?
That's right. Any friend of mine, no, it doesn't matter how close they are, if they tell me put every cent you have in something, I don't know about that.
But, I mean, he is, I guess, you know, subtextually you could say, by using that language, he's saying go all in.
Oh, for sure. I know what he's saying, but I don't know if it's something that you really should be paying attention to.
No, I'm just saying subtextually that what the message to George is, look, now is the time, you know, the decision you're going to make, you're going to go all in, you know. So I suppose you could argue that there's a little bit of subtext going on there for him in terms of his connection with Mary.
Do you think Sam is trying to get Mary and George together? Or he doesn't care either way.
You know, it's, I'm talking about the subtext of it.
No, like, I understand that. I realize that. No, I realize you're talking about the subtext. So I'm just, you know, the general question. Does Sam understand what's going on? And the obvious answer is no. Especially since, you know, on the surface, it seems as if Sam was calling because he was interested in Mary. Even though via subtleties, we've pointed out that that's not true. But
that's not true.
That's what the movie is trying to tell us up until that point. You know, with the with the way that her mother wants to make sure that you know, she talks to him and she answers the phone and that she's around and all that stuff. So, you know, it's to give us the impression that Sam is interested, even though.
Yeah, that's so great, the choice that Capra makes where he does that cutaway to New York. Because if he doesn't do that, then you do think, well, wait a minute, Sam could still be interested in Mary. But you play it out up front where, oh, wait a minute, you know, maybe Sam is, you know, got some interest in Mary. And so you tease that dynamic tension that George is feeling. But then we, with the dramatic irony, the audience gets to see him in New York, and we now know, oh, no, he's not interested in her romantically. He's got this other stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So I like the way that they do that. So,
that's great.
So, again, he says to him, put every cent you've got in the stock. Do you know where the term cent comes from?
Well, let's see. Centennial. So it probably has something to do with 100.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. It means cent means 100. It comes from the Latin word centum, which means 100. The use of cent in a monetary unit means it's always going to be 1/100th of whatever monetary unit is that you're using. And the symbol for it is a lowercase c, and they actually put a diagonal stroke or vertical line through it, making it look like the what we know a cent symbol looks like. It's a c with a line through it. The nickname for the 1 cent coin is a penny, which is basically there's a British coin and unit that is known as a penny. So they're just alluding to that. So that's where cent comes from. So it's just, I just find it very interesting that, you have the 1 cent piece, but no one calls it a cent. Mm-hmm. Only when you're talking about it in passing.
Percent, like percent. That's probably tied to that word too.
Well, right? Percent is from 100.
Yeah, from 100, yeah.
You know, so you're, 70%, it means 70 of 100.
Of 100. There you go. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I also love the fact that he says that this is going to be the biggest thing since radio. So it's just very, very interesting that he's very confident that what he has is going to be something that's just gonna knock everything out of the park. When do you think the term radio when do you think they started using the term radio?
Wow. You mean a reference to the actual, I don't know. I have no idea.
So it originally was known as radio telegraph. Or radio telegraphy. That was the original name of it. And in 1904 is when they started using the term radio. Again, it's just a shortened version of it. Beforehand, they used to call things wireless until they decided to change the... Obviously, radio has changed the world at the time because of the way that you were able to send, voice recordings over sound waves, over the, you no longer needed to use lines the same way that they were using beforehand with the telegraph and stuff like that. Because then they were able to create like transmitters and stuff like that, which would which would, I guess, make things what we would call now a cellular or wireless, the way that they did that.
Well, you know, I guess there's a point where you could say, again, you know, on the text of it, Sam's excited about this business proposition, plastics, and he's talking about radio, and he's, you know, he's got this sort of grandiose notion, and you'd think that that would appeal to George, because George wants to do something big in his life. And so on the text of it, this would be something that could be enticing to George. You know, I may even have a job for you. So this goes back to the point, like, they're presenting a path. Frankly, this is the first time that George has had a legitimate opportunity to leave Bedford Falls, if this thing were to come through, you know, like a job working for Sam's company. But subtextually, what the whole point of this, and he goes on, is when you go to the next part of the dialogue, ground floors, and put every cent, go all in. The subtext is like, jump, go, do. And the physical proximity, what's going on for Mary, the emotional subtext that's been playing out all underneath this, is what he finally responds to. Sure. And I do like the idea that there is this kind of subtext going on with Sam's sides, where he's saying, go, jump, do, you know, go all in. And eventually that's what George does. So, but George, Sam's not, you know, he's not kind of, all he's doing is, he's making a sales pitch, you know, but he doesn't realize it emotionally. I think that it is settling, speaking to George's inner need. So that would be a way to interpret this whole thing here that we were just talking about, this side from Sam.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, the great thing I like, what I really enjoy about it is the fact that they have, you know, we hear Sam over the phone saying all these things, but we're watching the reactions of George and Mary as they're getting closer. I mean,
yes.
You know, we see that you know, their heads slowly get a little closer to one another. I mentioned yesterday that, you know, even that today we can actually see a point where it looks as if George is smelling her hair, taking in her scent, understanding that you know, that this is what he needs. It goes back to what you're saying about the, you know, the needing and wanting. It's not just that he wants it; he needs it also.
And that's a smart choice by Capper. He does the one take cutting away to Sam, just to establish A, he's living the high life in New York. B, he's not really interested in Mary as a romantic interest. And he doesn't cut away again. Everything else, because he wants to stay Capra, wants to stay on George and Mary in that physicality of that moment.
Right.
So you can see the evolution of the feelings and the proximity and the smelling and the touching. Her lips are almost on his lips. You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's building that sense of emotionality,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's going on here.
Right. And then we can also see that they're not really paying attention anymore to what Sam's saying. You know, they're paying more attention to one another than to what's being said. And then at this point, you know, as I read before, Sam basically says that Mary needs to tell George that he's giving him the chance of a lifetime. And he even repeats it, the chance of a lifetime. You know, and as you've already pointed out, this chance of a life, because at this point, then Mary says to George, and as you've pointed out, you know, this phrase, the chance of a lifetime, is referring not just to this business opportunity, but also to this relationship opportunity. You know, he's in a very unique position. It's done just really well.
Yes, absolutely. Chance of a lifetime. That's it builds toward this whole thing, is exactly that, where he does have a chance of a lifetime. And it's in the moment, the way when Mary says it, I mean, literally face to face, nose to nose, he says it's the chance of a lifetime. Actually, in the scene description, that says George can stand it no longer. He drops the phone with a crash, and then he grabs her. So it's like it's built to this moment. It's really an interesting reaction
mm-hmm.
that he has.
Yeah.
Right, but I'm sure you want to get into that. But right. Yeah, the chance of a lifetime, absolutely subtext.
Right, he snaps at that point where she says to him, it's the chance of a lifetime. And he grabs her.
That's a snapping point.
That's right. He grabs her as you said, he drops the phone. And then he goes, now you listen to me. I don't want any plastics. And I don't want any ground floors. Which is very funny the way he says it. And I don't want to get married ever to anyone. You understand that? I want to do what I want to do. And you're, oh, Mary, George. And, you know, he's very forcefully shaking her.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it goes back to what was she said earlier in the week, that he's violently making love to her, or making violent love to her, you know, by shaking her like this. I don't know. But
oh, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that. It is kind of a callback to that. That's a really interesting
especially since we know the real explanation of what they were referring to when they said making love. So it makes more sense that, you know, he's violently shaking her. I mean, she starts crying, and thankfully she's not crying because she's being violently shaken. It's an emotional thing.
No, it's, yeah, she's emotional. I always looked at this as like, if you think about want and need, that language, and he doesn't really know what he wants, even though he's saying, I want to do what I want to do, right? But that this reaction, this kind of anger, this shaking thing, that's the last gasp of his want, where the need takes over. The need is this need for domesticity and for romance and for love and family. And that's finally what wins out. But it's like that final sort of frustrating, no, I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to give in. Whoops, I am going to give in. Again, it's such a great, it's an expression of the conflict, the inner conflict he feels. And in this moment, that's the breakthrough. The need overcomes the want, at least temporarily. And so, boom, there he and Mary are together. Yeah,
correct.
Great moment.
Yeah. It really is. I really like the way that that they end this scene between them. You know, that they now they're both on the same page, because he's realizing that you know, he both wants and needs Mary in his life. As much as he says, you know, as much as he said that, you know, that you know, he doesn't want anything. He doesn't want the plastics. I love what he says. He doesn't want any ground floors. You know, because, you know, he makes it sound as if it's something physical, that he doesn't want the physical ground floor, as opposed to,
but it's,
you know, because it's a metaphorical ground floor.
Building a life together, starting off something.
Correct.
Yeah, so this is where need transforms his want until they merge together, as it says in the script, in tearful ecstasy.
Okay, that can also be misconstrued. But or misinterpreted, but thankfully, and that's how this minute ends. We're gonna have to wait until Monday to find out what happens after he's violently shaking her. So Scott, did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Just that when we talk about subtext, there's a dialogue subtext, but there's also emotional subtext, and much of the great writing, it comes to dialogue, is to look for that, like what's going on underneath, because that's where actors love to be, where they're playing the complexities of the moment. And that's where it makes us more of a participant as a viewer, where we're just not hearing the text, but we're actually interpreting what's going on emotionally and psychologically with the characters underneath their words. And this scene is just a great example of that.
Yeah, it really is. All right. Thank you very much for that. So every Friday, we have a segment called Oscar Oops. So the whole idea here is that over the last 95 years of the Oscars, there's always, every year, there's controversy. You know, people agree, people disagree with the choices and stuff like that. And the idea is here, I wanted to see what my guests think were possibly the five biggest goofs in their opinion as to what movies should have won, as opposed to that won Best Picture at the Oscars. The only small caveat that we have is that you can only choose something that was actually nominated for Best Picture that year. So what have you got for us, Scott?
Well, I can go back through time. I'd start out in 2018 I thought Roma deserved to be Best Picture, not Green Book. I thought Roma was a fabulous film, Alfonso Cuarón, you know, true cinema. You know, Green Book was, you know, okay, but Roma was great. Then I go back to 2005. I would have selected Brokeback Mountain instead of Crash. I mean, Brokeback Mountain was a conversation starter. Crash was, I don't think it's aged very well, Crash, now. I know a lot of people think it's kind of hackneyed, but I don't take that perspective. I just think that Brokeback Mountain with Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger and Ang Lee directing, I think it was a superior film.
Well, I think Crash is just not something, it's not as memorable. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I mean, in Brokeback Mountain is.
Correct.
It's just the intimate story of these two. Yeah.
Yeah.
1994 is tough because, I mean, Forrest Gump is a terrific film, but you've got Shawshank Redemption, which I actually went to the premiere of that because I did a movie with Castle Rock.
Oh, wow.
And that movie, you know, is number one movie in IMDb Top 250, mm-hmm. has been for years. But I'd have to give the nod to Pulp Fiction. I mean, Pulp Fiction was, you know, he'd done Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino, but Pulp Fiction came out, was just a, you know, talk about memorable.
Yeah.
So that was a great year when you think about it. But I would have picked Pulp Fiction instead of Forrest Gump, which, again, was a terrific film, but Pulp Fiction was just a stellar thing. Then I go back to one of my top five favorite movies in 1964 was Doctor Strangelove. It's one of my top five movies of all time, Doctor Strangelove, instead of My Fair Lady. I mean, Dr. Strangelove was arguably the best satire, or one of the best, including maybe Being There and the Network. But Dr. Strangelove is just a phenomenal film. And Peter Sellers does an incredible job playing three different roles. And then the last one would be 1944. The winner was Going My Way, which is okay. But Double Indemnity came out that year and was, you know, it's a classic film noir, and Billy Wilder's my favorite director. I love Frank Capra, but Billy Wilder's my favorite director, so I would have picked Double Indemnity instead of Going My Way in 1944. So those are five of my choices for best pictures that I wish had won that didn't.
All right, very cool. That's great. Okay, thank you very much for that, Scott. So is there anything you want to say in general about It's a Wonderful Life? It could be about anything.
It's one of those movies. Yeah, it's one of those movies, and we've talked about it a bit. It's one of those movies you can watch over and over and over again and still find new things. There's a moment in the movie, which I noticed the last time I saw it, where Jimmy Stewart or George has jumped into the river to save Clarence. And they're in the that station, the toll bridge office. The guy is chased out.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a conversation with Clarence on the left and George on the right. And in the foreground is this rope where they have clothes hanging, and it's like separating the two. And it's just a great little visual thing about the separation between, you know, an angel and a human, and the separation between where they're at that point, because George doesn't believe this guy is an angel. And so you find these tiny little, and like you were saying, Capra is a very visual director. You find these little bits of business, these things. It's just it's one of those movies that just keeps giving to you if you pay attention to it.
Well, it is originally called The Greatest Gift. So
there you go. Greatest Gift. Yeah.
All right. Great. So, Scott, would you like to, for one final time, explain to people where they can find Scott Myers?
So there's my blog. Go into the story. DonorDoTheStory.com. Based off my little kid, I was going to write a script the next day. He was about 3 years old. I was attending to his bath. I said, I'm writing a new story tomorrow. I'm a little concerned about it. You get any advice? I was just joking with him. And he looked up at me and said, go into the story and find the animals. And so that's what I named my blog, was Go Into the Story. But then I wrote a book called The Protagonist's Journey, An Introduction to Character-Driven Screenwriting and Storytelling. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. It's done quite well. It's got endorsements from almost 40 at this point, screenwriters, novelists, and academics. And so I recommend people check that out if they're interested in learning a little bit of a different way of writing stories where you come at it from the perspective of the characters first.
All right, great. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, Scott, thank you very much for joining me this week. I feel that I've learned a lot. I've been enlightened by the way that you look at this movie. So I appreciate that, and I thank you. Hopefully the listeners will get that same feeling.
Well, I've enjoyed it and learned a lot, and I think what you're doing is a real service for people who are cinephiles, you know, to be able to go through movies in depth like this. I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing.
All right, great. I appreciate that. So you can go in and tell people that they should be listening. There you go. You should give that as a class assignment. Tell your students to start.
I got a couple of people in mind. I got a couple people in mind that I may very well do that. That you would probably be pleased to hear. they named their production company Bedford Falls. So you know. I think I'm gonna mention to them that they should check out this podcast.
Oh well, you can get them in touch with me. I'll have them on if they want. I've heard of Bedford Falls production company. I'm trying to remember where
it's Marshall Herskovitz and Ed Zwick's company. They did 30 something.
Okay.
You know, My So-Called Life.
Yeah.
So they named their company Bedford Falls.
Right. Actually, I did know that. Yes. Send them away. I think I tried contacting Martin at some point and he didn't respond, but maybe after you tell him that you should speak to me, you know, maybe he will, you know, it's not just some stalker.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Great.
Well, great. Again, I enjoyed the time. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. And I appreciate you taking the time for this. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest, but until then, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.